Hello, and welcome to episode 72 of the Planning Period Podcast, your Ed Breakroom. I'm your host, Brad Scheffler. This week on the show, I'm joined by Dave Burgess, the author of Teach Like a Pirate and owner of Dave Burgess Consulting and Publishing. Truly, does he need more introduction? Dave and I talk about becoming the Dave Burgess, teaching like a pirate, the overemphasis on standardized test scores, balancing accountability and autonomy of teachers, the power of social media and sharing your story, the inequalities of curriculum in high-need schools compared to other schools, ways to improve homework for our students, the three kinds of passion, how to and why you should read wide and live wide, and how great coaches and great teachers are related. I really enjoyed this episode. Dave has amazing energy, and I hope you do as well. So, sit back and enjoy episode 72 of the Planning Period Podcast, my interview with Dave Burgess. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of the Planning Period Podcast. I'm your host, as always, Brad Scheffler. I feel like in a lot of episodes recently, I've made the commentary, if you don't know who this guest is, you've been living under a rock. And while that's been true for my other guests as well, it's probably the most true for my guest today, who is just simply the pirate teacher, I think is what he's known as most often. And that is the one and only Dave Burgess. How are you doing today, sir?
Hey, I'm doing fantastic, Brad. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Yeah, absolutely. I am very much happy to have you on. I really do appreciate that so much. For my audience, who I'm sure know at least, Teach Like a Pirate, but could you just give them an introduction of who you are?
Yeah, for sure. So I was a high school teacher, U.S. history teacher for 17 years. I'm the author of Teach Like a Pirate and also the president of Dave Burgess Consulting Incorporated, which is an educational publisher and consulting firm.
Yeah, and you guys are doing big things. Now you're full on publishing. You're doing a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah, we just put out our 59th book. So it's kind of surreal to even say that out loud, because that was never the original vision. The original vision was we just wanted a way to publish Teach Like a Pirate in a way that could control the message and all that. And that the rest has just kind of been quite a journey.
Yeah, I always feel like the consequential ideas, the things that you didn't really mean to have happen, can be the most effective and powerful sometimes.
Absolutely. I think you're right. It's the people that think they can plan everything out ahead of time are usually the ones that it never works out how you plan anyway. So sometimes you just have to just go for it.
I agree. You know, that almost lines up with the vision of Teach Like a Pirate in general. I mean, that's kind of some a part of it is that improvisational component to enhance students, right?
Yeah, I think there is a lot of improv. So the ability to capture the teachable moment in class, I think it's an important thing, and to allow those moments to occur and to not pass them by in the pursuit of covering, you know, more and more curriculum in a superficial way. But when the moment arises, taking advantage of it and diving down into something that the students are interested in, I think that is a big part of of what Teach Like a Pirate is about.
Cool. You know, I have to ask this because I just have this vision of you in my head where, you know, I came into the connected educator sphere past the point where you were already the Dave Burgess. So I was not around for your evolution, as it were. But in my head, there was a period of time where you were just a weirdo who walked around conventions in pirate gear and no one really knew why and everybody thought you were crazy. How do you get from that point to where you are now? Like, how does that how surreal is that experience? And what was that experience like for you?
So first of all, I have to tell you, Brad, you exactly nailed it. That is exactly what I was. I was a crazy guy walking around the conference dressed like a pirate. Nobody knew who I was. And I was at a stage early on in my career where after I came up with the Teach Like a Pirate workshop, I did it first in my district. And then I began to go anywhere where anyone would listen to me to talk about these ideas. I just had this like almost like this evangelical zeal for spreading the message. And so I submitted conference proposals everywhere. And if any conference in any state said, yeah, you can come to your pirate thing here, I got a plane ticket. I got a hotel room. I bought a conference registration and I went and I did my thing. And so it was absolutely, you were absolutely nailed it. I was just that crazy guy. And so often today I'll hear people that'll come to me and say like, hey, man, I wish I could, you know, you get paid to go speak at these conferences and all. I wish I could do that. I have this message I want to spread. And I'm like, are you, get paid to speak. Are you kidding me? When this first started, I would go in. I mean, we spent so much of our own money and lived below our means in order to get this message to take off, and did all sorts of, you know, it's kind of like that iceberg. You see the tip of the iceberg, but then below the water, you don't see the hours in social media. You don't see the all the different states I went to, and was just going from conference to conference and just trying to get my message in front of people. I knew if I could get it in front of enough people, then it had a chance to take off.
And I mean, obviously it has. I think that's a given. You know, I was first introduced to your book when my district bought some absurd amount of them and were distributing them out by the truckfuls, just like, here, take 20 of these. You know, and it's one of those things that they were very much supporting. And we have multiple teachers in our district now who, you know, support your message through, you know, sort of representing it out with their own twist and spin and everything. So, you know, it's definitely something that it has caught on. It's a thing. It is definitely a thing, as you would say.
We fully endorse those truckloads, by the way.
Yeah, no, I can imagine. I think that is probably the best way for someone to buy someone else's book, is buy the truckload.
There you go.
What is the most succinct, if you boiled it down to its simplest term, what is teaching like a pirate?
So teach like a pirate has nothing to do with the dictionary definition. We do not want teachers to attack and rob ships at sea, right? It has nothing to do with criminal behavior, anything like that. To us, it's about the spirit of a pirate. And the spirit of a pirate is someone who is unconventional, someone who's willing to reject the status quo, someone who's willing to sail into uncharted waters with no guarantee of success, a risk taker, a rebel, a maverick. So it's embracing that spirit of being a pirate. It also happens to be an acronym. So the P-I-R-A-T-E of pirate is an acronym. Each letter stands for something. And then in addition to that, pirates are known for having hooks. And this is all about how you could add hooks to your classroom, to your content, to your curriculum, to draw students almost magically or magnetically into what you're doing in the class.
Man, you just like, you're a man who doesn't let metaphor live on one level. And I really appreciate that, because you're everywhere with that metaphor. I feel like sometimes, you know, if I envision in my head a crazy guy walking around a conference like a pirate, it's only for the hook, right? Or it's only because, okay, pirate makes a convenient acronym. But you get it on all, you're firing on all cylinders, as it were, I would say.
Yeah. No, there's three levels to the metaphor, and all three are super important.
Yeah. Excellent. All right. Well, I don't want to spend a ton of time talking about teaching like a pirate, not because it's not a valuable method, but I think you have been on a million podcasts. I've heard you on multiple other shows, and I think that that has been provided out there for people. So I would rather, as someone who has been all around the world and spoken to teachers everywhere, I'm very interested in your opinions on education as a whole. And so I'm going to sort of jump right into my normal three questions for my guests. And my first question for all my guests is, what is the biggest problem facing education today?
So that's a super tough question. And there's probably, I don't know that there is a single biggest problem, but I think I could come up with maybe a couple ways to tackle it. So first of all, I think one is the overemphasis on standardized test scores and on measurements. Trying to measure things which don't matter and not measuring, and the things that do matter, we're not measuring. And because sometimes they're almost impossible to measure. And the example I always give with this is when I'm teaching the civil rights movement, what is more important, that my students know all the features of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, or that they are able to stand up to racism when they see it? They're able to fight oppression. They're able to stand up for other people and be a force and have the courage to be a force for change and support causes of equity and such things like this. Well, obviously the latter is the most important, but the first one is the one that's going to be on the test and the thing that's measured. And so a teacher could have a student not perform well on a standardized test, but have a life-changing class, which made the world a better place. And so I think that too often, because what gets measured is the test question, we put our focus in the wrong place in education. So that's where I would put the number one problem. And then I think that the fact that I chose that as an example of it, I think points to this, the, what would also be what would be one of the biggest problems is that as issues of equity in education and creating schools that are empowering for all students in all communities.
Hmm. All right. Two big issues. So let's dive into the first one, and we'll come back to equity, because I always think that's an important conversation to have. But let's dive into the test scores. You know, when people talk to me about an over-reliance on testing, I totally understand and agree. I definitely think we overly rely on that. However, I also believe one of the big problems we have in education right now is a funding issue, and one of the ways we see that is in limited pay for teachers. And I believe wholeheartedly that at this point in education, we are not encouraging the best and most effective teachers to stay in the classroom, because it is not a lifelong pursuit that allows for growth, that allows for a pay, that allows for a full-time, you know, to support a family or anything else. So I think in many ways, the funding issue causes us to push great teachers out in some way or another. And often, in my experience, we are left with some teachers who, not all, but some, are doing the best they can, but is probably not good enough for our students. So I think that we need a measurable system in some way. So how do you balance that out in your vision of perfection? Do we straight eliminate testing and I'm totally out of line? Or does there need to be some sort of balance that allows for both? Or do we need to find some way to measure that unmeasurable thing?
Yeah, so I'm not for throwing out all testing or all sources of accountability for educators. And what I think the problem is, though, is you do have to, it's tough to find that balance because of the, we haven't found a way to measure some of the other more important stuff. Some of that needs to be through observation, I think. Some of that needs to be through incorporating student voice into evaluations. And but it's a sticky subject, because anytime you want to put a number on something, you know, it's going to cause some issues. And we want teachers to go into we want our best teachers to go into schools and to teach in the most challenging situations. And so if it's strictly based on test scores, then I think that is going to be kind of a sticky point.
Well, and you touch on another issue there, which does go back to our equity thing, but the schools in the most need, when teachers are evaluated on the performance of students, it's an unbalanced equation there, right? Like we're telling our best teachers to go where they're going to get the best scores. And that's not going to be a school in need, because by definition, they are not going to have the best scores. That's why they're in need. So that goes to that equity piece, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the, we want to create, that's why it's so important to sort of level the playing field and to make sure that, all of the schools are equally are attractive and are funded, and you know, so we're providing that educational experience that's powerful for all students. And I'm not sure that that's something that's happening right now.
You are someone who has traveled all over the world and all over the country, obviously. Where, or I shouldn't say where, but I should say, have you seen any models that are maybe different than our own, or even places in the US that it seems to be working better than what some of us feel sometimes?
Yeah, so I'm not a doom and gloomer as far as education right now. I know there's a lot of people that are kind of jumping on the bandwagon of bashing what's happening in school systems and saying that it's a broken system. And in some cases that's true, but I also think there's incredible stuff happening everywhere. The problem is it's in pockets, right? There's pockets. This is something that like George Kuros talks about in The Innovator's Mindset, where he's talking about, hey, there's pockets of innovation in every system. So how can we take those pockets and make it something that is system wide? And so I think that's what the big challenge is now, is not that there's not great stuff happening. There is great stuff happening, but now let's identify it. Let's shine a light on it, and let's scale it. Let's move it and see it spread. And so I think that's where, I think that's one of the big challenges right now.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I think I'm on board in the sense that, you know, doing this podcast and interviewing people all over, it does become that question. You know, it does, I sometimes people take it as being negative, and I totally get that. But I don't. I think that where we're at is we need to sort of identify some of the systemic issues, because to what you're saying, systemic issues can exist, and there can still be pockets or people doing phenomenal things that are doing the best they can within that system. But I think I agree with you wholeheartedly. I just completely lost my train of thought in the middle of a sentence, but I totally agree with you that there are definitely pockets of greatness. And I think you're right. And now I totally don't know where I was headed with that thought.
Well, I think that's one of the powerful things that we're seeing in social media right now. And is that what used to happen in a school system that was powerful, there was very little ability for that to be shared and to spread. And now we're at a place where we're able on a global level to find people doing amazing things and share out those things and be able to connect and collaborate on a global level. And so I think that the ability to tell your story is something that's super powerful. And it's one of those things that gets criticized sometimes. And some people that are very good on social media say, they're being selfish, they're being egotistical. And no, they're telling their story. And if you have something that can help other people, you not only should be telling your story, you have a moral imperative to tell your story. Because if you have something to help other people, you shouldn't just share it. You should take the time to get good at sharing it and to be able to spread that and to be able to take it so it's going to be able to impact and affect other school systems. So I think social media is a fantastic avenue for shining a light on some of these pockets and helping them spread.
That's a bold statement to say you have a moral imperative to share your story. And I love it. I really do like it. That's awesome. Yeah, because you're right. If I have a good idea, if I have something that's working great for my students, presumably it should work for someone else, you know? And I often think about when I joined Twitter and realizing there were other people out there doing the things I was doing or doing things like me or better than me, you know, it was like this realization, because I felt like I was the weirdo because no one else on my campus was doing the stuff I was doing. And then all of a sudden, I wasn't just the loner off by himself. I just happened to be that loner in that geographical region. But there were tons of other people with similar ideas and concepts to me. It's eye-opening as well.
That's absolutely true. And Seth Godin wrote about that. He had a book, I think it was called We're All Weird. And he talked about this, that now, so if you were that person that was into some crazy, small, tightly targeted area, it was super hard to find other people that were into what you're into. But now we can find our people. We can find in our community, we call it the crew, but you can find your tribe, your crew, your people. And so it allows you to connect with people. And maybe you're not getting the professional development in your school system. Maybe you're not getting access to new and innovative ideas. Maybe you're not finding people that are uplifting you within your school system, but now you have the ability to connect with those people outside of the school system. And you said something that was super powerful. You said that you weren't sure, that a lot of people aren't sure that what they have is special and unique, but it is so much is, and people are so fearful that, well, no, other people are probably doing this, so I probably shouldn't share it. No, first of all, a lot of people aren't doing it. Secondly, even if they are doing it, they don't look at you when you share it as like, oh, look, they think that they invented it. No, it just validates their work and their practice. And also, there's a lot of people that are fence sitters. There are people on the fence that are trying to decide. They kind of want to try something new, creative and innovative, but they're kind of a little bit nervous at the same time. And when you share your story, which includes you sharing your struggles and your failures as well, right? When you share your story, that gives them often the courage to take that leap, to get off that fence and to go try something new. And so it's super important that we get out there and share our work.
Excellent. I like it. Talk to me a little bit about more. Talk to me. That was awful. Talk to me a little bit more. There we go. About this equity issue you see in education.
Yeah. So I don't think that we have the same school system and educational opportunities for all students right now. And I don't think it's across all communities. And I don't think that that we have the same opportunities for the same empowering curriculum for all students in all communities. And you see some of our most challenged communities with the most scripted curriculum and with the least engaging school curriculum. And they'll usually blame it, you know, they have all sorts of, oh, they're behind the curve in test scores or an achievement, there's an achievement gap. And so we have to focus on this more rote fundamental work, when actually that's just putting them further behind in the world when they graduate. And so I think that that's a super big issue that we have to address in education right now, is making sure that students are have access to empowering curriculum and the opportunity to tackle tough, challenging work and creative work. And, you know, I always, one of the things, and lots of people talk about this, the old gatekeeper in the world was information. Who's got information? Who doesn't have information? That was kind of one of the separators. Well, now everyone has all the information. You can pick up your phone and you can get all the information. So what are the new gatekeepers? What can you do? What can you make? What can you create? What can you design? What can you code? And so making sure that students across, all income levels, all racial groups, all everything have access to the most powerful and creative curriculum and empowering curriculum, I think is a big thing that we should be focusing on.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I always, this is what, this to me is one of those issues that exists on every level. It exists within a school, it exists across a district, and it exists across counties and across the states. And you know, I always think about the closest example to me is, you know, students who are struggling in a, you know, a state exam on reading, we take away an elective to put them in a reading class. And, you know, that is that it always, I understand the need. I understand that they are struggling to comprehend reading and they need the extra time to keep up. But also, if they're hating school every day because they don't get any time to do something they're passionate about, you know, are we helping them through giving them extra time in reading if it takes away the thing that would make them want to be in school? You know,
Brad, that is a perfect example. And that's exactly the kind of thing I'm talking about. We do it all the time. Say that this is a part of school that you dislike, so therefore we are going to give you more of it. And we're going to take away the very type of classes, the very access to the type of curriculum, which would be something that would connect you to school and make you want to come to school and make you want to be a part of the educational system and develop that love of learning. We take that away and give them more of the other. And it's a problem for sure.
My concern becomes is the student is in that case behind because of their reading is behind, for example. So how do we, in a battle of time and a battle of funds, how do we get the student what they need without killing their love of reading or learning or whatever?
Right. Well, so I think part of it is more powerful instructional strategies and practices. And this is one of the things that I mentioned in Teach Like a Pirate. It's kind of confrontational, I know. Basically in the book, it says, it does not matter how much you teach. It matters how much they learn. And so you can focus on bell-to-bell instruction. You can focus on giving more time to students in areas they're deficient. But if the student is not engaged or feeling connected to that material, then it doesn't matter anyway. And so a lack of engagement in my mind comes from three things. It could be a lack of connection to their life. It could be overwhelm, or it could be boredom. And so making sure that we're focusing on curriculum that answers all of three of those, I think is one of the answers. And so it's not a matter of spending more time. It's a matter of spending time more effectively. And that's, you know, for example, when we talk about homework, one of the answers, I think, to the homework problem is it's how can we use school time more efficiently and effectively so that the homework isn't required? And what homework we do send home, can we make it something that's more of a self-interest as opposed to something that is going to actually destroy and kill the level of learning by what we send home? And so, you know, all these things kind of tie together.
Hmm. You know, you touch on homework and that one feels close to me right now, because I feel like there's moments where I feel like a terrible parent with my own son because I don't emphasize the homework his teacher sends home every week. And genuinely don't. And my father listens to every episode, and I know right now he's screaming at me because he's going to be annoyed that that's what I'm doing with his grandson. But that's okay. It's my son. I can do what I want. It's interesting because the homework she sends home, she's identified that it's optional, that it's enforcement. So on the one hand, it's optional. I'm not going to push him too hard to do it. On the other hand, it's supposed to be reinforcing the learning. But I feel like I don't think that's the best use of my time with him, because I would rather talk about the experiential things and get him to learn through doing things instead of, you know, doing his spelling bingo chart each month, which is great. And it's a very powerful practice. I just don't know that it's the best practice that I can reinforce at home. And I agree with you so wholeheartedly. So I see that from both sides, as the teacher and from the parent, and it can be challenging.
Well, and I think you're being kind and nice to say that it's great and a powerful practice, maybe, or maybe it's not, right? And I never got wound up too much about, I was not a homework, a teacher gave a lot of homework, but I was never really wound up about the issue until I went through what you're going through, and that I had students, my kids become students. And then I would see what was coming home. And I was seeing, like, are you kidding me? Wait, I'm going to fight a battle, right? My student's been in school for 6 to 7 hours. Mm-hmm. And now I'm going to have a battle at night about this worksheet packet that is supposed to be completed by tomorrow. Like, we're not going to go to this, to this sporting event that we wanted to go see together because these worksheet packets are due tomorrow. Like, not at all. And I could give you a couple of rants on homework if you're interested, but they would be rants. So I would warn you ahead of time.
I always love a good rant. Few things make me happier than a rant.
Okay, so here you go. So here's two ways for teachers to reposition homework in my mind. So the first one is when you go to a theme park and you go on the fancy rides, like the Mummy ride, the Excalibur ride, the Jurassic Park ride, as soon as you're finished on this exciting ride, they lift the little bar, take the belt off you, and where do you end up? They put you in the back of the gift shop. All these theme parks are set up this way now. They put you in the back of the gift shop, and now with your kid, you have to walk through the entire gift shop. And what does that kid want walking through that gift shop?
Everything.
They want everything. They want everything because it's all been themed to the ride that they just went on, right? And they're excited about it in that moment. And so when you get off the Jurassic Park ride, there's dinosaur sets and there's books and there's DVDs about dinosaurs, right? And you get off the Mummy ride, there's books about the pyramids and mummification and things with Egyptian symbols on them and all these kind of stuff like this, right? When I go to SeaWorld in San Diego here and I go through the shark encounter and we get on the little moving sidewalk and we go through the glass tunnel and the sharks are swimming over top of my head, right? Over top of our head. And as soon as we're off that moving escalator thing, we're in the gift shop. There's shark tooth necklaces and DVDs about sharks. And what does my son want at that moment? He wants all of it because he just saw sharks. They were just swimming over his head. He's like, how many teeth do they have, Dad? What happens if they bite you? Oh, look at that one right there. Look at how rows of teeth he has. He has rows of teeth. And then now at that moment, he wants to know everything he can about sharks. Well, that's how we have to look at homework, I think, is we have to focus on the powerful learning experience first. You have to get kids excited about your curriculum. You have to get people connected to it. And now, once you've had that powerful learning experience and they're excited about your subject, now you empty them into the gift shop. You show them where they can go further. Here are resources if you want to know more about this. Here's a project you could do. Here's an activity you could do. And rather than killing it with what you send home again with those worksheet packets and things like that, you offer them resources and places that they can further this self-interest that you've developed through powerful learning. And so I think that's one way to kind of reposition homework in your mind is you have to empty them into the gift shop. But it's only after the ride. You have to give them the ride first.
Huh. That's really cool. It's not at all. I think of sometimes as like the flipped model being a powerful way to at least turn homework on its head, but it's not that in the sense that you're giving learning in the classroom, you're setting them up for it, but you have to push that excitement so far that they want to keep learning on their own. That the first thing they do, you know, when they get home is grab their book out. I like that. That's a great way to do it. That's a really awesome. And I think we could do that in our classroom, right? Like we all teach, especially when you get into middle and high school, we picked the subjects we teach because we're excited about it, at least for most of us, right? Like we're excited about what we're teaching. So why do we always seem to lose that excitement in the way we present it to our kids?
Yeah, well, that's the challenge. I think one of the things that I do is I break passion into three categories. Because for example, I was a history teacher, but just to be completely honest with you, I will not finish this podcast interview and go turn on the History Channel. I'm not going to read some historical fiction tonight, and I'm not going to go read the latest biography that's come out on one of the presses. That's not who I am, right? And so my passion was not always around my content. So one of the areas of passion you can have is in your content, okay? But then there's two other areas of passion that I think that we need to tap into. The second area is your professional passion. So what is it about being an educator that you're passionate about? What is it about that mightier purpose of being a teacher, tapping into that and creating those life-changing lessons for students? So for example, I might not be passionate about railroads, right? But I can find something that I'm passionate about, whether maybe I want to talk about how to become like an entrepreneurial mindset. Maybe I want to talk to them about some civil rights issues that had to do with immigration and railroad workers and working conditions and unions and things like this. Maybe there's some things like that I could be passionate about that I could tap into and create a life-changing lesson around it. So that's the professional passions. And then the third area of passion is your personal passions. What is it completely outside of being an educator that you're passionate about? And how can you tap into some of that in the classroom? And so like I'm trying to convince educators to bring more of themselves to work every day. We're at work too high of a percentage of our lives to unplug ourselves when we walk through the doors of the building. And so it's when you can combine all three layers of this, that content passion, that professional passion, and that personal passion together. That's when you really become relentless in the classroom and in the pursuit of excellence and greatness.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I'd just like drop mic, call it a day. I think we're good. Just pack and seal it there. Yeah, I agree completely. And I know for me that I spent, I've said on the show before that my pre-Twitter teaching, I was definitely not the guy that did that. I was the guy that I loved words, but that was about it. And I came in and I did my job and I did it. And then it was that once I got really introduced to Twitter and understood what other educators were doing and had a better grasp of things, and I started to bring myself into my classroom more wholly and completely, that was when I started to get it more and my kids did better and everything connected. And you know, like you said, like all firing on all cylinders, like I said before, it just kind of all connects. So I agree. And I like that three divisions of passion. I think that's a great way to look at it. And they are kind of like three distinct things. So I think that's good. I like that. That's excellent.
And that was a matter of survival for me, just to be honest with you, because I was not a history major. I was a psychology major. I got my gateway drug into teaching was as a basketball coach. So I was hired as a basketball coach before I even had a teacher credential. I was hired as a basketball coach at the high school I worked at. And then I went back. I loved working with the students so much that I went back to night school and got my teacher credential and became a classroom teacher. And so history was not some lifelong passion of mine. And so I was going to be in a situation, I know it's important for me to be fired up about education. I call it the deep, dark secret. The deep, dark secret is that we know we're supposed to be passionate about our work, but we're not passionate about everything that we teach. So how can you find passion and bring passion into your career on days when maybe your content isn't something that you're passionate about? And that's when I decided that I really had to find some other places to find passion and kind of tapped into those other two circles, the professional passions and personal passions.
I like it. That's excellent. Very well. You're just dropping gems everywhere, as my friend Dr. Will would say, just dropping gems. I love it. I love it. I love it. I love it.
Thank you.
We've been going for 30 minutes on my first question. So I guess maybe we should look at my second one. Just, why not? So let's go to my second question for all my guests, which is, what is something you're doing that you wish all educators would do?
Okay. I think we already tackled the connected piece, which would be my first answer. It was a game changer for me, literally changed my life to become connected. And so that would be, but we've kind of already tackled that. So I'm gonna choose another one. And that is to read wide and live wide. And to have how can I use that mindset when looking around the world? So one of the key pieces of Teach Like a Pirate is asking yourself, how can I use that? Like, for example, what is going on in the world around me right now that is engaging people? How can I use that in my classroom? What do other professions use to engage their audiences? How can I use that in my profession? What are kids into outside of school? How can I use that inside school? So always looking around and having that, how can I use that that mindset? Teach Like a Pirate is a strange book. I'm going to tell you something that's strange about it. There's not one single education book referenced inside of it. Not because I don't like education books. I publish them, right? It's because that's not where it came from. It was from the outside drawn in. It was my background as a coach, for example, influenced how I break down instruction, how I give feedback to students, how I develop a motivational component to my class. Like maybe like how a coach can get a team ready to knock down walls coming out of a locker room. Like I can get my students ready to knock down a wall, right? My background as a magician influenced my sense of staging and showmanship and incorporation of props and things like this, right? My background as an MC has influenced my professional development speaking style and my ability to speak in a fast and flourishy way in front of people, right? My background as a marketer and entrepreneur and a lover of success literature has influenced how I bring those life-changing lessons in and how I tap into marketing principles to deliver content and sell content to students and get their engagement. And so all these things have come together to create the best me, right? But Teach Like a Pirate is not about teaching like me. It's about teachers finding what's unique about them, their unique strengths and voice, and for them to look at the world around them and try to tie into that as powerfully as they can. And so rather than focusing so much time in the education section of the bookstore, for example, I would say read wide, and you're going to find unbelievable applications for your classroom. It's sort of like it's a creative alchemy. It gives you ammunition from other areas of life to draw back into your classroom.
Read wide and live wide. I think that's not only good for education. I think it's just a great way to live life. But it's interesting you say that, because I've told on the show before a long time ago that one of my best teachers of all time was my high school English teacher my senior year. And one of the things that made him so fascinating was this game. It was AP English, AP literature. So we kind of had this wide variety of things we would read and analyze. And we played this game with him all the time where we would just try to come up with a subject that we as a class collectively knew more about than he did. And we never succeeded. And it was insane, other than the occasional pop culture reference that, you know, was only, you know, came out a week before that, maybe. But other than that, he knew more about everything than all of us. And I still always remember back to that as just this fascinating experience of wanting to emulate that wide depth of knowledge that I thought was so fascinating. And that's just what I'm thinking about as you're saying that. And it made him a more well-rounded teacher. And I think that you're right in that all of our life experiences, all the things we do and experience and know and read and hear, they fill us up in a way that we shouldn't just be depending on educational reading and educational literature. And I think that's a great way to look at things. I do agree. If we would all do that, we would be a lot better off.
Yeah. And I think that you tapped into something super powerful there, Brad, too. And that, first of all, you know that about your AP teacher because he allowed for that informal banter in the classroom and for that game to be played. And he was willing to share that he had his lifelong learning. He was modeling it and he was sharing that with you. And it wasn't just about the curriculum. That was something that's, you know, you're talking about that how many years later now, right? And that was a powerful moment, and it didn't happen inside of the curriculum. It happened on the edges. So much of the powerful impact that we have on students happens on the edges of what we do, not necessarily in the formal instruction time. And that, I think that you tapped into a super powerful moment in that class with that teacher.
That's awesome. Yeah, I like that. I had never really thought about that experience that way and how it led to sort of the way I live my life in a sense. That's interesting. You got me thinking, and I'm sure that you got my audience thinking. So that works out really well. But I don't do this show for them. I mostly do it for me. So who cares? Wow. Yeah, that's cool. So live wide, read wide, live wide, whichever way you want to go about it. I think that's a great, I would add listen wide because I'm obsessed with podcasts more than reading. So I would say listen to a wide variety of shows, which I also do. So I agree. Absolutely. Completely. Excellent. Oh, Dave, we're rocking and rolling. I've only got one more prepped question ready for you. So I'm going to go to my last question. And it was a good transition with me just talking about one of my best teachers. And my last question for all my guests is always, who is the greatest teacher you have ever had?
So I'm going to go with John Wooden on this one. And so I, of course, never played for John Wooden as a basketball player. However, my first job that I ever held was I worked for 3 summers for John Wooden at his basketball camps. And so at a very formative time in my life, I spent weeks and weeks every summer for 3 years being exposed to the teachings of John Wooden, seeing him interact with campers, with parents, with coaches. And it was an absolute game changer, life changing thing for me. And I got to see him deliver his pyramid of success every single week for 3 years and learn something new every time. I got to see him, you know, he is not only one of the greatest coaches, if not greatest coach of all time, but I think the coaching and teaching, the overlap is incredible. Great teachers have a lot, incorporate coaching, and great coaches incorporate teaching. And so I would definitely say John Wooden.
It's interesting. I've said on the show before that most often in my experience, English teachers are the most common answer to that question. And I think over 72, 73 episodes now, coaches are starting to make a drive to the top. They're trying to push their way up to that top spot now. That's interesting. I you know, for you to kind of pick more or less a boss, since you were working for him in a sense, is kind of an interesting take or answer to that question. I don't know that I've had that before, but I like what you said about great coaches and great teachers and the connections between those, because I agree wholeheartedly that those two things are definitely connected in a lot of ways.
Yeah, absolutely. 100%. And there's a couple of points to make about that. First of all, coaches, people who do work with students in extracurricular ways, whether it's drama, whether it's music, whether it's coaching, whatever it might be, they have really strong and powerful connections with kids, partly because of that edge time again. They have that time, that informal time, where maybe it's bus trips to games. They have meals together in some cases. They're chit-chatting while stretching in the locker room before a game. And all that edge time that you have for a kid, that's the most powerful time to build rapport and relationships with students. I have no data for this, but one of the things that I always say is 1 minute spent informally with a student is worth 10 hours of class time. So 1 minute of formal interaction with informal interaction with a student is worth 10 hours of formal instruction as far as building rapport with that student. And think about how many of those minutes that people that work with students in extracurricular ways have, or who run clubs on their campus, for example, and the students come in at lunch or whatever it might be. Advisors have this opportunity too, you know, like the class advisors, and that it's finding opportunities for a classroom teacher to do that is a powerful thing. Coaches have it built in. Music directors have it built in. Drama, that's already built in. So as classroom teachers, how can we find that time to have those informal conversations? Much like, and again, it goes back to that AP teacher moment. That was informal time that you had that we were playing that game and you were realizing, wow, this person knows everything about every subject. This is amazing.
Absolutely. Well, Dave, you have dropped some wonderful information on us today, some great ideas, some thought-provoking stuff. You've sort of changed the way I've looked back at my own memories, which has been interesting. And, you know, I genuinely appreciate you. I can't believe we've been gone for almost an hour. I really appreciate you chatting with me. It's been an awesome conversation. I really, really appreciate it.
Hey, you know what? I appreciate you having me on the show. Thank you for sharing your story and helping other people share their stories through the podcast. I think that's a super powerful thing. I too am a podcast lover. And so I think this is a powerful medium. And I know we had some blips getting this on the schedule, and I appreciate your patience with me and my schedule. And thank you very much.
Yeah, absolutely. For my audience, if they would like to get a hold of you, how is the best way for them to go about?
Yep. So I'm always on Twitter at Burgess Dave. My name just flipped around to Burgess Dave. You can find me on Instagram, DBC_INC, DBC_Inc, and at DaveBurgess.com.
Excellent. Well, Dave, thank you again so much. I really appreciate you for taking the time to talk to me.
You bet. My pleasure.
Have a good one. Dave, thank you so much for taking the time away from your very busy schedule to talk to me for this episode. To connect with Dave, find him on Twitter, at Burgess Dave, on Instagram, at DBC underscore Inc., and on his website, daveburgess.com, and of course, links to all of those are in the show notes. If you have comments or questions about the show, you can always connect with me on Twitter. I'm at Brad Schreffler, and I'm the same on Instagram as well. I love to hear from you there. That's also a great place to connect if you'd like to be a guest on the show. Or check out the feedback page on my website, which gives you options for feedback as well, which you can find at bradschreffler.com/feedback. Until next week, remember that you have a moral imperative to share your story. Music for the Planning Period podcast is the song Vicious by Kevin MacLeod, used under Creative Commons. You can find him at incompetech.com. The Planning Period podcast is also a proud member of the VoiceEd Radio Network, a 24-hour radio network all about education all the time. VoiceEd Radio, your voice is right here.